The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Lawyers have high exposure, high risk to burnout because of the nature of the work. You are pulled in lots of directions from the client, from your position, from the judiciary system, from the regulatory system, from the bosses, you know, and your partners and the colleagues that you work with. There's a big pull. So the demand is huge on an individual, and that can be very, very taxing.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Hearing. I am your host, Tanae Frazier. In a culture that teaches us to work hard, achieve our goals, and then work even harder once we've achieved those goals, there's not much discussion about how working in these high-pressure, results-driven environments, how they're impacting our mental health, how they're affecting our physical health, or our well-being as a whole. In a previous episode, we discussed mental health in a legal community and how it very much is in a crisis. This is a follow-up to that episode, where we're going to explore how to first recognize the need to take care of ourselves with the same fervor as we're taking care of others, and the tools and the practices that we can institute, as well as firms, to ensure our workplaces are psychologically safe and the mental health and the well-being of our teams and of ourselves are a priority and not a casualty. And my guest today, Carrie Lawler, a co-founder and a psychotherapist at the Workplace Collective in the UK, is going to help me explore this topic.
The Hearing.
Carrie, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited to talk to you. And I know that you serve as the psychotherapist director at the Workplace Collective. And your firm, it offers psychological support and supervision to lawyers and other professionals. But before we get started talking about the amazing work that you do at the Workplace Collective, I want you to give me a little background about your therapy background and also how you got started working with attorneys.
Yeah, gosh, that's a good question. How did I get started? Hello, Tanae. It's great to be with you here this afternoon. I was thinking about this actually. Because I was the last child of 10. So you can bet that I very early doors learned to listen. 5 brothers, 4 sisters. I learned to listen. I learned to watch. And I learned to read what was going on, what the body language was, who was saying what. And I think probably I became a listener really, really early doors. And some of my like earliest childhood memories are listening, watching, observing, seeing the kind of antics that happened in my fabulously blended household. And I kind of go back to that because I think actually that sort of sensitivity, that empathy maybe were skills that I think I probably had really early. And at 14, I was marched over the road where we lived. There was an old people's home and I was marched over the road to go and get a job. And I, for 4 years prior to going off to university, worked 5 days a week, sometimes 6, in the nursing home with the little old ladies. And listen, I did. In fact, as we'll know, many of them suffered from dementia. And so listen, I did to the same story on repeat. And I think it was kind of part of who I was. So my father, Irishman, the only thing that made him excited was the idea that I would be a businesswoman. And so at 18, as the only one of his children that made it through to university, I was sent off to do a business degree and off I trundled. But on the very last day of my shift in the old people's home, the matron turned to me and said, "Why are you not doing nursing?" And it was the first time that anyone had sort of highlighted that I had this kind of skill of being with people. So I kind of scratched my head and said, "Well, business is what it is. And off I went. So had my first career, really, 10 years working in kind of corporateville. And But very quickly into that, actually, I took over, I worked at a national marketing agency post-qualifying, and I took over running the intern program and all the work experience and all the kind of gorgeous young people that were kind of coming in and wanting to experience what it was to work in that sort of setting. And in strolled a new graduate by the name of James Brown. And some of the listeners might recognize that name, James Brown, because he's now one of the co-directors and owners of Hall Brown Family Law. So he loves to tell the story that I was his boss for 6 months because it makes me out to be loads older than him. but he was my intern for 6 months or so, and we struck up a fabulous friendship. He's hilarious, really great guy. And take of it what you will, he moved from marketing into law and has had a career ever since. So cut to, I guess, probably 10 years later, I decided to retrain after my second child to in psychology. And then I switched that over to psychotherapy, so kind of applied psychology. And 5-6 years later, having done various levels of and finalizing with a master's degree, I was working as a psychotherapist and in lots of settings, actually, in women's centers, in youth centers, in young people's groups and schools. And then one day I got a phone call from my friend James Brown, who said, "Hey, we've set up a new law firm. We want it to be different. We want our staff to be really well cared for. Will you come and talk to us about offering this thing that you do to my team?" So, and that was 6 years ago. And so that's how I found my way into working with attorneys. That's a kind of whistle stop tour. But we were doing this exercise of reflective practice, this exercise of psychotherapeutic support with his team before I even realized it was a thing. And in the last sort of 3 years, I've become much more aware of it as a practice that is kind of used in other settings and in other firms. And of course, coming out of the UK Law Society and Law Care and the SRA as an intervention that really supports the mental health of lawyers. And so, and really, I've stolen it from the world of psychotherapy, because for us, the idea of doing the work that we do without clinical supervision is kind of mind-boggling. And so we've just kind of stolen the best ideas of that. And here I find myself. So, 6 years ago, I started working with a gaggle from paralegals right through to partners. And I love it. I absolutely love it. So, and then, of course, 2 years ago, I set up the Workplace Collective with a colleague, and my work has expanded across various other firms.
Wonderful. Now, Kerry, can you tell me what reflective practice is?
Ooh, that's a really good question. And there's some dispute, really, as to what to call it. Some people call it clinical supervision. Some people call it supervision. Some people call it reflective practice. And actually, I don't really like the word supervision, because I feel like it kind of implies a kind of power over. And I think in law firms, we have supervision as a kind of oversight, accountability, a kind of compliance, a kind of risk checking, a kind of managerial role. So supervision for me kind of butts up against that. I like to think of it not as power over, but kind of power with, alongside. So I prefer to call it reflective practice. But in effect, it is a method of thinking really deeply about your work, thinking, reflecting deeply about the impact of your work on yourself, on others, on your clients, on your colleagues. And as a practice, we sit, for me, in one-to-one and think about the client work, perhaps things that have kind of got under their skin perhaps that month. We talk about the kind of wider context of life in a firm and the impact of working in a setting. And we always talk about what's going on for people personally, because sometimes those things are really significant. Life throws us lemons, doesn't it? Curveballs and things, and they impact our ability to do our job well. So that's kind of broadly what I call reflective practice. But honestly, it's different for every person that I interface with across the settings I work in.
Why is it important, particularly for attorneys?
I think attorneys swim in very complex water. I think that what we know from the research is that attorneys have high levels of mental health distress. In fact, I think the statistics show that 63% of working lawyers experience stress every day. And I think I've got the statistics here in front of me, 71% of those in a Compass Mental Health Survey last year, the LM, experience anxiety. And we know that that is just increasing. So the statistics tell us that they are not doing well. But the reasons for that, I think, are multi-layered and really systemic. And actually, I don't think it is just that it's one thing. It's definitely not just the individuals. It's the workplaces, the settings. But it's not even just that. It is the wider cultural issues, the societal issues that are impacting people in workplaces. And further to that, I think that the education, the training that lawyers receive in working with humans and humans' distress, especially in family law, which is where I specialize, is enormous. And people are not trained to be able to deal with that as well as they might be. In fact, someone said to me yesterday, a lawyer said to me yesterday, you know, like 5% of our job is law, the rest is psychology, the rest is people. When I think about, you know, the wider issue, I think we live in a kind of culture of hustle. I think people are used to kind of being busy and being, you know, successful means that, you know, I'm kind of straining and pushing the bit. But I think that we also have changed the way society sits, and I get all existential on you, but I think we've culturally, people are living in isolation. Lots of people are living far away from family units, so living alone. I'll never forget the Monday morning client that I picked up. And she said she hadn't spoken to a single person all weekend. I was the first person since she logged off on Friday that she'd spoken to all weekend. We live in a pandemic of loneliness. We know that. So I think people don't have the social structure. So when we think about the kind of wider system that all of this sits in, there's complexities. And good Lord, this week, when we think about what's happening politically and we think about, you know, people's financial crises, we know that that's impacting a lot of people's personal lives. So I think, you know, there's a kind of really big issue, macro issue around the settings that we're all working in. And I think that's why the stats for depression and anxiety and mental health issues in workplaces are so huge. I think with one in four, 20,000 people a month being signed off work with work-related absence across the UK, what is it, 75 million lost days or something? Massive. So that's an issue. And that's even before we start to think about a law firm and that setting and the complexities that we find, the unique, I think, complexities that we find in that setting, because they're difficult places to work, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. They can be. They definitely can be. And one of the things that I have come across is that by nature or by design, lawyers are acclimated and adapted to working in these high pressure environments. And some might even attest that working in these high pressure environments is how they thrive and they come to the top. But it's having an impact. And I want to go deeper into the impact that it's having on their mental health. I heard you mention depression and anxiety. Tell me more about that. What are you seeing when individuals are coming to your office or you're counseling these individuals and they are telling you about their high pressure work environment and how it's impacting them?
Yeah. I guess I witter on about statistics a lot, but actually these are individuals. These are people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for us to acknowledge that these are individuals that I think care very much about their work. But most of them, across all the settings I work in and in other professional settings, most of them are high functioning, high achieving, as you said. And this is something that they've been their whole kind of school career, usually task orientated, you know, high performers, high output, exactly as you said, Tanae, thrive on pressure. In fact, take the pressure off and they're a little bit lost. So we see a cumulative response, I guess, because often when you have a high functioning, high achieving human, they don't have an off button. It's like the accelerator on a motor car is just kind of fully down. So actually it's very difficult to downregulate. It's very difficult to rest and replenish. It's very difficult to have weekends off and not feel guilty, not feel like you ought or should be doing something else or something kind of meaningful or something valuable, learning something new or doing some work, I suppose. So that inability to switch off, I think, is one of the reasons why it exposes people to the kind of cumulative effects of stress. Because stress in and of itself isn't bad for you. And most of us work at a kind of perfectly balanced level of high levels of motivation and drive that make us able to write that letter and deliver what you need to do on deadline for your clients or in court. That's great drive. That's great stress, really helpful and useful. But there's a tipping point where it becomes distress, where the cumulative experience of multiple stresses, which as a mammal, we weren't really designed to be exposed to, I think builds up and builds up and builds up. And that's something that we describe as that kind of burnout phenomenon, the idea of the cumulative exposure, repetitive exposure to high stressors. And that high stressor for me might be different from that stressor for you. And everyone has a different kind of capacity and tolerance for stress. But certainly when we know that someone is exposed to repetition and a kind of constant bleed of it, they're likely to experience some feelings of their system overwhelm. And what does that look like? That can look like anxiety, so hyper arousal, overthinking, ruminative thinking, racing thoughts, and anxiety, well, as does lots of mental health issues, then has a physical impact on the body. So a heart rate, breath change, kind of a kind of panicky feeling, at its kind of tricky end. And anxiety can be debilitating. And for some people, ruminative overthinking keeps them awake at night or wakes them up at night. And can kind of interrupt and make kind of procrastination, so, you know, task avoidance, be really overwhelming. So we see that and I see that across the board with professionals in every setting I work in, as well as the burnout phenomenon, which can often, I think in many cases, people realize that they've kind of hit a wall when they have like a physical symptom. So they suddenly notice that their memory is depleted, or they lose time maybe, or they suddenly take ill with an illness or a kind of some sort of physical symptom unexplained. We see lots of tummy issues. We see lots of head issues. I see lots of clenching, kind of mouth issues. Our body kind of goes into overwhelm and then can shut down. And it can take a really long time to recover from that, and kind of rest is required and removal from the stresses. So burnout is not to be trifled with. And I think the law care study tells us that lawyers have high exposure, high risk to burnout because of the nature of the work. You are pulled in lots of directions, both from the client, from your position, from the judiciary system, from the regulatory system, from the bosses, you know, your partners and the colleagues that you work with. There's a big pull. So the demand is huge on an individual, and that can be very, very taxing. And some people's tolerance to it is less. And it can fluctuate because most of the individuals I work with, I would consider to be the most resilient, the most hardy, the most capable humans I know. And but then life throws a curveball, a bereavement, a miscarriage, a family breakdown, a divorce, perhaps, and they are depleted in their resilience to be able to then hold everyone else's stuff.
How does an attorney shift their mindset from being in this constant go mindset to now I am recognizing that my body is showing the effects of these high stress situations? How does the mind shift from saying this is no longer serving me?
Yeah. Good question. And it, interestingly, I think perhaps in the case of burnout, there can be no illusion that they need to do something because suddenly they're not able to perhaps function in the way they are. But if we take that as the kind of furthest point, and then we take kind of everyone else in the middle, the 63% of lawyers that experience stress every day, what can they do to recognize that they need to take care of themselves? And I think that this is why individuals like me and colleagues that do the same thing, particularly I can speak about the family law arena, is the access to support. But before that, it's self-awareness, isn't it? Self-awareness is absolutely critical. Sort of, I call it the U-turn. You kind of U-turn into yourself and you notice how you're doing, and a kind of realistic appraisal of how am I actually doing? An asking of your partner or your colleagues to recognize I'm not doing okay. And so it's tricky. It is tricky because when that accelerator is on full pelt and you know nothing other than, the drive for perfection, next task, to pause and to stop and to turn inward is something that is tricky, both psychologically and internally to kind of check inside. But I think it's also tricky when your diary is as it is. And I think it, certainly in some of the settings I work in, often what people will say, I just don't have time to do reflective practice because I'm just slammed against it. And I would argue that it's the reverse is true, that actually not having time to do it reduces your productivity, reduces your resilience, reduces your wellness. Your concentration, perhaps, your kind of ability to manage your emotions. So I'm going to say this, Lanto, that I think reflective practice is a brilliant tool for people in workplace settings and outside of your workplace to reflect on how am I doing. And that's why in lots of the settings it's a monthly check-in, so it's in the diary, and sometimes they'll say, this is the first time I've thought about how I'm doing all month. It's literally the first time I've turned inward and thought, how am I doing? How am I doing? How am I doing? And so having that kind of diary note with self is, I think, a really important date in your diary to visit yourself, as some of my colleagues say, to just take a visit. How am I doing?
I can imagine that with the reflective practice sessions, that some attorneys may have just a bit of aversion to maybe opening up fully for fear that maybe their manager or their supervisor may become aware of what they're dealing with. How do you all deal with that?
Yeah, absolute firewall of confidentiality. And I wouldn't have stayed very long in my job if that had been different. And actually, I think it's perhaps important to say at the Workplace Collective, what I do is I ask if I can be made available to the staff, but for them to be able to access me directly. So via my email or my telephone, so that they don't have to go via their line manager. And in actual fact, I'm granted with enormous trust that I don't report who I see. So I client code everyone with a number, and the you know, head of families, the managing partners, they don't know who I'm seeing in the team, and that enables access. That enables people to be able to come and talk to me without fear that it might go against them in some way, or that it them thinking that perhaps they're working on their mental health means that there's something wrong. And we do butt up against that stigma. Unfortunately, we still do. So my policy is confidentiality. The contract, they're kind of working alliances with me, and I'm an independent subcontractor in effect, and therefore I don't have to feed in any of the information that they share with me into any of the bosses in the organization, which in some ways is a shame. I sometimes think, good Lord, I'm the kind of story keeper here on the shop floor. I'm kind of like exposed to the good, bad, and the ugly, I guess, in lots of ways. And I wish I could feed in the things that are done well and the things that have caused frustration, but I don't. That's not my role to play.
Is there a requirement that law firms offer this service or this this support system, this reflective practice at their law firms, at their workplace?
Not in the UK.
Mm.
No, not yet. I say not yet because I think that there is quite a lot of firms now voluntarily taking this up as a response to mental health crisis in workplace settings. And in the UK, for sure, there is a health and safety exec, a requirement for workplaces to manage work-related stress. That's mandatory. But that doesn't necessarily translate into what those interventions look like. In almost every setting I work in, firms have an employee assistance program, so access to health benefits. And universally, that has been the kind of box tick of, well, if our team have mental health issues and stuff's going on at home, then they're able to access psychotherapists or a psychologist via our kind of EAP scheme. But I think increasingly the SRA in the UK and Law Society and Law Care have been kind of pumping out the data around mental health, looking at the thematic review of wellbeing, looking at best practice guidelines, looking at ways to improve the mental health of lawyers, and reflective practice is considered to be one of the kind of gold standards for that. So there's a kind of view that perhaps down the line this might become mandatory, as it is in the psychological world. It's mandatory for me to have reflective practice, and it's possible that it might become mandatory. And there is some talk about it perhaps being driven by the insurance companies, perhaps, because exposing employees to high levels of work-related stress, perhaps from, you know, high intensity, you know, 16, 17, 18 hour days, weekend working, having that kind of exposure might actually end up meaning that insurance companies insist that employers have some mandatory supervision or mental health oversight in place. So that's kind of the musings out there. And I guess just on that, there is an idea that, in fact, I read a report from Travelers Europe, an insurance company, that said that a lot of the errors that were happening in kind of professional negligence claims were to do with kind of human error, to do with slips and lapses, I think is the term that they use, this idea that people that are burnt out, fatigued, maybe, are making human errors, making mistakes, and that is causing perhaps law firms to have a greater exposure to negligence claims, and therefore that there might be an idea that actually improving the mental health provision in law firms will increase the client outcomes and therefore reduce the potential risk to the firm. So again, we're kind of potentially, will it become mandatory? I don't know. I was reading, I don't know whether you've come across Desi Vallhos, I'm probably not going to say her surname right, in Australia. Australia seem to be kind of leading the charge on this, and they have changed their health and safety statute quite significantly in the last couple of years to really not just saying there's a kind of mandatory broad brush statement to look after the mental health of your team, but they have identified this term psychosocial risk hazards. So looking at what are the psychological risks that employees are exposed to. And that means, you know, for the design of the work, the kind of delivery of the work, the interpersonal relationships in a workplace setting. What if we can identify what those hazards are, we then are duty bound to put strategies in place to protect our employees from the exposure of those psychosocial risks. And that seems to have been a kind of significant pivot in Australia for firms really having to, instead of kind of wellness, mental health wellness being the icing on the cake of a workplace setting, it becomes the cake. The cake has got to be baked right with the right ingredients to be able to mitigate the hazards of this work. And I think that's going to, it's certainly shifting stuff in Australia. And my hope would be that that washes out perhaps into America and into the UK, because I think that would improve things for everyone.
I agree.
The Hearing. You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes, every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Although not mandatory, I believe in 2023, the Solicitors Regulation Authority passed some guidelines on well-being and mental health for law firms. Can you elaborate on that some?
Yeah, the SRA did. They did a big piece of work, a thematic review of well-being in the law. And they are insisting that firms do everything they can to protect the mental health of their staff. But again, they've fallen short as to making mandatory requests upon that. So there's lots of guidelines, and there are well-being guidelines for law firms. And one came out only a few months ago, the Mindful Business Charter for the Legal Profession. The Mental Health at Work Act in the UK has set out some an outline of best practice. The Law Society has best practice guidelines, and those are all robust interventions, and they are about turning the ship in terms of workplace culture. And I think they found that in some settings, they described it as toxic culture in work in law firms. And in those cases, there's a kind of a duty of care to start to think about changing the culture to make them more psychologically safe environments for people, to make them inclusive. We know that some of the highest risk of mental health distress are women, are those from ethnic minorities, are those from LGBTQ questioning communities, and looking at victimization, bullying, harassment, and discrimination. Those are kind of really big top level, you know, board level, partner level initiatives that need to start to kind of wash down into workplace settings. I talk about the cake often. Well-being, mental health well-being isn't just the icing. We have to have a kind of big shift in workplace settings to make it, to lose the stigma, to make mental and emotional wellness recognized as a kind of priority and a key to performance. You know, let's not forget from where I'm sitting, it's a strategic business decision to invest in your staff. It increases their performance, it makes them able to thrive, it makes our workplaces desirable places to work. We want to recruit the best talent, we want to retain the best talent, and I think increasingly, and especially with this younger Gen X coming through, they're looking for workplace settings where there is work-life balance, where they're not expected to work 18-hour days, where their ability to balance healthy self-care with a career is expected. So I think there's strong, really, really strong commercial reasons. Absenteeism from mental health related days, I think I told you, didn't I, 72 million lost days in a year in the UK. And there's a blast zone to people being off sick with mental health, because it doesn't just impact one person, it impacts all the people that their workload lands on. And we're already talking about people with high levels of work intensity. So keeping people in work and keeping them healthy and keeping them well and keeping them with high emotional intelligence, I think is just straight up commercial sense to me. And reducing the risk of error, human error, it's a no-brainer, I guess, for a law firm to invest in.
I'm hearing a lot of benefits for the law firms, a lot of benefits for the law firms that are going to ultimately benefit their employees. But how would a law firm create and implement such a supervision or reflective practice program in their firm? How do they go about implementing this?
Yeah, so the idea of reflective practice, I think, as a kind of initiative, can be delivered in several ways. Obviously, there is a burden on an individual to think about their own practice of reflection. Sometimes I call it cognitive reappraisal, which is the kind of official term that we use to describe this idea of becoming kind of mind-minded, turning inward. So number one, individuals can do it. Individuals perhaps that are listening to this who aren't able to access it through their law firms could most certainly begin to do this themselves. And I would suggest, a diary, a 30-minute check-in with yourself, sit on a particular chair, turn inwards and ask yourself, how am I doing? So number one, there's a kind of burden on the individual to take care of their own mental health. And there's lots and lots of ways that you can do this. Lots of ways that you could think about. There's one called the internal mentor. This is the idea that you have this kind of wise self that's an extra voice apart, perhaps that you kind of dialogue with. So you're asking, you know, how am I doing? Not great. what could I improve on this week? Or what have I missed out on? So you can do it to self. And then, of course, you can do it in groups. Although, I'll be honest with you, Tene, I actually experimented with a pilot of running reflective practice groups in a law firm, and it didn't work so well. And I'm not sure that was because of me. I think actually it was tricky. It's tricky being in a room with people that compete against each other and actually who are kind of constantly thinking about how they come across. And, you know, and I think it meant that vulnerability and expression was significantly diminished. So I think that group reflective practice in some settings works, but perhaps in some law firms it doesn't work so well. So the kind of gold standard, and I would say this, wouldn't I, is to do it one-to-one with a facilitator so that you actually have an individual that is available, or a team of individuals in the case of the Workplace Collective. There's kind of a cohort of us that are available that your team book into, again, directly. So I know, for example, that I sit on lots of intranets internally so that if people want to access reflective practice, they can just contact me directly. I like to see it very much as proactive, but sometimes it's reactive, and sometimes people reach out because they've got a particularly tricky case or a client. You know, from time to time, clients I'm thinking of an example of a client who took their own life, and the impact on the team in the firm was huge. And of course, that's something that I can react responsively to. But I like to think of reflective practice on the whole of being something that's proactive. It's kind of front-footed. It's building up your resilience. It's learning this is a mechanism for how can I reflect on, how can I shift perspective? Look, I sometimes use this example of a snow globe. I sometimes say that you are in the snow globe. And when we come to intercession, you're in the snow globe and you're kind of being bashed about, shaking around, there's kind of flakes are flying, caught in the eye, and you're kind of stuck in the situation. And through the process of reflective practice, through kind of stepping back and witnessing, you kind of come out of the snow globe, and then the snow globe is in your hand and you're kind of looking at it and you're seeing a situation as an observer, as a witness. And that kind of level of mind-mindedness, we call it, enables you to have insight, enables you to have clarity, shift your perspective, see things in a different way, and then maybe respond different. Maybe learn to develop your skills to do it different next time, or to perhaps think about it in a different way when you're kind of lifted out of the snow globe. It's really, really helpful. So I don't know if I answered your question well, Tene. I think you said, how would a firm go about doing it? I think accessing someone like me in the UK, there's the Association of Family Family Law Supervisors, or approaching psychotherapists trained specifically in working with professionals. I think firms could certainly introduce this initiative.
Great.
For their teams.
Now, I read one of the case studies where your firm came in and enlisted this program and these services. And one of the things that just stuck out to me was that they said they were really happy to have a specialist that was able to enlist these services as opposed to just a case manager or a manager from the department. And I'm gathering from that it's because you all have the expertise to deal with the issues that are coming before you, or someone that is sharing whatever mental health issue they're having with you, as opposed to just your regular supervisor or another employee just hearing you out.
Yeah. And so I think there is a place for without a doubt, and it is mandatory supervision for the matters of law. Supervision for how the client matters are impacting their emotional and their mental health, I think perhaps are skills that are placed well with someone like me as a psychotherapist. One of the things I haven't mentioned actually, and I should, is the exposure, especially for family lawyers and for those that work with kind of high levels of human distress, I guess, in things like immigration too, is something called vicarious trauma, 10A, this idea of secondary trauma. So the experience of being traumatized because of the stories and exposure to material that is traumatic. And I think that is certainly something that we are now aware that family lawyers are exposed to high levels of vicarious trauma because of the content of their client material. And in child matters, in safeguarding matters, in family breakdown proceedings, we see domestic abuse, we see all manner of violence. And individuals are having to listen to, and in some cases be kind of live in it. When a client comes and there is, you know, a domestic violence situation, you are in the story. You are part of the story, live, and it matters. And so that exposure to vicarious trauma, my colleague Joanna Fleck wrote a fabulous book, Vicarious Trauma in the Legal Profession, a few years ago from her research of vicarious trauma turns up. In other terms, it's described as compassion fatigue. It turns up in people's lives. And I think it looks and feels like your own experience of trauma. So it can look like PTSD. It can look like burnout. It can look like anxiety and depression. Secondary trauma, being exposed to other people's trauma, is damaging. And I suppose it's really important that we acknowledge that this content that they swim in is also highly charged. Lots and lots of human distress, both, you know, upset and disappointment and frustration but also anger and conflict and vitriol and you know, horror. And oftentimes they're on the receiving end of phone calls and emails and multiple emails, and holding that level of human distress is not insignificant. And I think I mentioned about, you know, training. Lawyers are not trained to deal with that. And actually, I think when I think about some of the work that I do with the individuals, because of the nature of vicarious trauma, I think it is handled well by somebody as a psychotherapist or a psychologist that is able to handle the secondary trauma experience that our lawyers are facing.
What can law firms do to change the culture within their law firm from one that is high pressure, result driven, to one that is somewhat balanced? Yes, we need to get work accomplished, but we also need to take care of our employees. What can they do to foster that?
Yeah, that's a $1 million question, isn't it? How long have you got? 10A. Should we hear it 10 o'clock tonight as I start going through my list? I think it's important for it to be kind of partner led. I think it needs to be from the top down, number one. I think we need to recognize that mental health issues in law is not going away. And I think the impact and their duty of care to their employees is something that can't be ignored. And actually, interventions need to be put in place. I'm not one for thinking that tokenistic, you know, the odd lunch and learn and some fluffy cushions and a kind of breakout space with you know, a beanbag is going to cut it. I think we really need to think about, you know, full scale interventions to making workplaces psychologically safe, that mistakes can happen, that people are able to communicate and articulate when things have gone wrong without fear of repercussion. I think we need to think about improving our communications, you know, across the board. there is lots of guidance out there for firms large and small. And I think if I were to suggest that people seek out support from places like LawCare, the Law Society and the SRA to look at what the guidelines are saying in terms of what best practice could look like. But there's so much talk about offering, improving work flexibility, reducing the pesky chargeable time issue. I don't know if you experience that. And I sometimes think people, professionals, don't know stress until they've had to account for every 6 minutes of their day. And in fact, I think there was a Gen Z study that said that of the top five reasons why this younger people would leave a firm, it is if they could have a reduction in billable hours, if they could have more flexible working arrangements, and if they could have more time off. In fact, I think they said that they would take a reduced salary in order to be able to have that kind of extra flexibility. And I think that would take a big shift, wouldn't it? Because we're used to people working in workplaces. I think COVID had a big impact on people being able to work from home. And I'm all for that. I think for some people, it suits them much better. There's lots of disadvantages too I could witter on about. But effectively, I think that firms could look at perhaps looking to support flexibility. One of the groups that I work with are parents, are lawyers, somewhere between 25 and 35, new parents. And doing a job in law when you have an infant is really taxing. And I think especially given that most of us now live away from our family members, it puts a huge pressure on a lawyer's day when they have to drop off and pick up at nursery, and then don't even talk to me about the child being sick and the nursery saying they can't come in for 48 hours and you've got a hearing or you've got a important partner's meeting that you can't get to because you can't leave the child. And that, I think, ups the stress for so many working mothers, and I think is a significant issue that I think that there could be some more flexibility perhaps in some settings.
Out of all of the benefits with reflective practice and how you stated that this is some of the ways that law firms can address this issue, what are some of the key takeaways that you want to just leave with our audience in regards to how someone can get access to mental health care outside of their law practice? If they're noticing some of these issues or some of these symptoms that you mentioned earlier, what are some of the resources that are available to them?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tene. And I think that's an important one, because for lots of individuals, they will not want to go via their workplace to talk about their mental health. So in the UK, obviously, we have the fabulous NHS, which means individuals can present to their GP with mental health related issues and certainly access support via the NHS. And that can look like therapy. That can look like some time off, perhaps, if they've kind of hit a wall. And that is available to them. But I know that LawCare, the charity here, fabulous charity. And I think they have a free telephone line. And they've had tens of thousands of lawyers calling that over the last few years. In fact, I think they said that they've had an increase of callers to that over the last couple of years. So I would suggest that people call the LawCare line for immediate resource, and then perhaps go to their GP. And of course, there is the private sector. So moving into accessing private psychotherapeutic support or supervision. And there are lots of us around. I'm on the BACP, the British Association Directory. And of course, those people that have benefit of an employee assistance program might be able to access therapeutically also outside of their kind of workplace awareness. through that too privately. So there are some, there is resource available. If you're listening to this and you are managing a team, a partner thinking about mental health and well-being, please do something. Have a look at the Mindful Business Charter, have a look at the mental health at work, see how far away you think you are from those sorts of interventions and start to do something to improve mental health across your organization. And if you're an individual lawyer listening to this thinking, could this help me? My suggestion would be that you try and that you engage in really proactively taking care of your own mental health. There's a longevity required of most of us in our working lives to be able to kind of stay at the plow, as it were. And to do that, we have to take care of ourselves. We have to invest because nobody else will do it for you. You have to invest in your mental health, just like we would invest in our physical health. So don't kind of do nothing and wait until you kind of hit a wall and slide down it. Start to think about, now, how could I improve my own self-care? What could I do to improve my performance and my resilience? Because it can make a huge difference.
Thank you, Carrie. I've heard people ask, what does that self-care look like?
It looks different for everyone, Tene. I think self-care, I'm sort of chuckling as I'm sitting here because I'm thinking about, I read an article about someone saying, I wish people would stop talking about bath bombs and self-care. Self-care is not running a bubble bath. Self-care is investing kind of really robustly into things like boundaries, saying no, setting time limits for your scrolling on your phone so that you're not numbing for hours on Instagram, for example. Self-care looks like addressing your addictions or your coping strategies. Is that alcohol? Is that recreational drugs? Is that exercise or too much exercise? Or is it eating? What are the ways in which I'm not caring for myself? And sometimes I say, imagine that you're caring for your child or somebody that you love. What does care look like? What does compassionate care look like? Do that to yourself. And so often we're the last, we can be the last people to look after ourselves, especially in a service like law, because our job is to look after other people, not to look after ourselves. So thinking about food, thinking about a diet, thinking about exercise, thinking about reflective practice, thinking about your emotional health and well-being, thinking about your relationships, having boundaries, all of those things can improve how you show up in the world. And that's self-care. Hopefully that bath bombs go a long way, but they're not going to cut it if you've done an 18-hour day. And you're still logging on at midnight to check your emails before you go to sleep.
And how would one overcome the feeling of guilt when it comes to, I am no longer taking all of my energy to care for someone else, but now I am directing that back to myself? I hear a lot of people say there's a guilt there when it comes to saying no to others and yes to self.
Yeah, that's a tricky one to answer. How do we overcome guilt? I think number one, being aware. I would say that, wouldn't I? As a psychotherapist, we talk about self-awareness all the time. Being aware of that emotion, being aware of that sensation in your body of there is a discomfort in me saying no. There's a discomfort in me protecting my time. There's a discomfort in me resting because I feel like I ought to be doing something more. Because if you can kind of catch it and notice it, then you're able to respond differently to it. And I think therapeutically, how do we get someone to move away from a feeling that they ought to be doing something? I'd begin to look at things like core beliefs, things about how you show up in the world, things that you might have learned from your family of origin, things that you might have learned about how the world works. How can we start to unpick why you think that laying yourself down and serving others at great cost to yourself is a healthy mindset. How can we reprogram you to kind of shift away from that? It's a great piece of work. I love doing that kind of shifting, but I think it's a great point because I think that lawyers often have high levels of self-criticism. I think that you have quite high levels of imposter phenomenon. So the idea that, you know, I'm going to get found out, that I'm not really good enough to do this job. And I think because of the kind of perfectionistic and the task orientated high functioning stuff, you can often be slam dunked into guilt and feeling kind of an overwhelming sense that it's your job to save the day, your job to be a superhero, your job to be the rescuer. And of course, in often cases, you know, you take that role on for your client, but we don't take care of ourselves in it.
That's a great point. Thank you so much, Carrie. You've done a wonderful job sharing your knowledge with our audience. We really appreciate it, especially on a subject that is often thought on, but not often talked about.
Yeah, thank you. I hope it's been helpful.
Very. Thank you.
Thank you, Tene.
The Hearing.
I found my conversation with Carrie both interesting and, dare I say, selfishly therapeutic. Saying yes to self and no to others is not something that is easy to do, but it is necessary. Instituting reflective practice strategies, creating workplaces that are psychologically safe, are all things that benefit the legal community as a whole. Thank you so much, Carrie, for chatting with me today, and thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do like and subscribe for more content. And if you want to comment on anything you've heard today, then email us at thehearing@thomsonreuters.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.